Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom to talk about the 1987 action movie classic RoboCop. We touched upon the levels of satire, the themes of humanity and self-realization, and if we truly would buy that for a dollar. RoboCop is one of my favorite movies ever. Andrew had never seen it before. Unlike Predator, he likes this one. It's a great chat and a great time discussing it with Andrew on a discussion. I'm here once again with Andrew from theandrewblog.net to talk about, this time we're talking about an 80s action movie. We're talking about RoboCop. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Robbie, and I am extraordinarily excited to get to talk about RoboCop's 1990 appearance, Saving Sting in WCW, which I assume is going to be the main topic of discussion today.
I mean, if you want to talk about 1990s, like early 90s WCW, I am 100% for it. Most people think it's terrible. I, in fact, love it.
I don't want to talk about it in general. I just want to specifically talk about RoboCop Saving Sting.
Oh, I mean, we will mention that? It's not really a...
It's the core of the movie. It's what the movie builds to.
Yeah, it builds
to... It's how he gets his humanity back.
It's a Sting. Yeah, rescuing Sting. We're already extraordinarily off topic, but that's okay. There is a t-shirt commemorating that from back in the day that it's extremely hard to come by, and I really would want it, but it probably, if there were actual like vintage shirts available, they probably cost like $3 million, and I'm not going to pay that much money for a terrible t-shirt from 1990 with RoboCop.
It's a sound decision
with RoboCop and Sting on it, even though I do love RoboCop and I do love Sting, so it's hard. I'm conflicted. Yeah, we're talking about RoboCop 1987. We talked about my favorite action movie of all time. That's Predator. I think this is number two now. This is past Die Hard. Die Hard for a long time was number two. I think RoboCop is number two for me now. Die Hard's number three.
I will say, as somebody who likes both Die Hard and RoboCop better than Predator, it is a tough call. They are very different movies. You know, they're kind of making similar points in certain ways, but they go about it very differently to my mind. So I don't know. It's a tough call. It's probably one of those, which of these 80s action movies did I watch last? That's the one that's going to pull ahead in my mind.
I think Die Hard, I feel like I get most of what I'm getting from Die Hard every time I watch it. Like, I'm not getting new things from it anymore. I'm just kind of like, it's Die Hard. It's still great. And it's still very entertaining, but every time I watch RoboCop, I've seen RoboCop. Andrew, this is your first time watching RoboCop, correct?
It is. I'm popping off the seal for RoboCop for me.
I've seen RoboCop probably 50 times in my life.
That is a lot of times.
It is. I love RoboCop. I've seen it, like, I literally watched it maybe like 2 months ago. And I watched it again. I watch RoboCop for fun. I don't need a reason to watch RoboCop, but I did watch it again just for this podcast because I love RoboCop. You do enjoy this versus it felt like you were, like, you texted me, you're like, I thought RoboCop, you, like, you had to make sure that I understood that you like RoboCop versus...
Well, you know, when somebody... when somebody recommends a movie to you, when somebody says, I want you to watch this, I think you will enjoy it, you're always sheepish if it turns out it's not your favorite thing in the world. But it's also exciting when somebody says, hey, you should watch this, it was good, and you turn around and say to them, yes, it was. Yes, I did like this, especially if you're me and 80s movies in general are not necessarily your cup of tea for the most part. So it's nice to find the diamond in the rough and to give you credit, Robbie, for identifying it for it.
I mean, I'm... Andrew, it's not, I would, it doesn't, I, you could be anyone. I don't care who you are. I will espouse my love of RoboCop and tell you should watch it because it's great. I don't couch. There's some movies I would couch my recommendation. I'm like, you know, this or that. RoboCop, I'm like, do you like good action movies? You like action movies. That's really it. Like, you should watch RoboCop. It's great. It's great at a lot of things. It is more than just an action movie. Like, it is, like, a lot of my action movies, my favorite action movies, they're action movies wearing, like, it's like a skin of action movie. And then there's something else underneath. And this is satire. And I don't know. The RoboCop has a lot of, it, like, at a surface level, it really is like, oh, there's a cop and he's a robot and he fights crime. And you're like, okay, that seems stupid.
Well, it is one of the things that I like about this movie is it does work on multiple levels. If you are somebody who just wants to come into the film and watch a movie about a guy who gets robot parts and then shoots up a bunch of bad guys, this has that for you. There are good action scenes. There are good explosions. There are good shoot 'em ups. That's what you go to the movies for. It delivers. But if you want to look under the hood, there is satire. There is thematic heft. There is pathos. There are interesting bits of commentary there. Like, it's, I am almost always a fan of movies that can connect with the audience at different wavelengths. And this definitely fits that bill.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's really, it, watching it over and reading through the production of it and how it got made. And it really, every time I sit down and watch a movie and really do research on it, it seems like every great movie is a fluke of nature. Like, there are so many choices along the way that feel like any, like, there were certain choices they made in making this film. If they had gone a different way on any of them, I would think this movie was significantly worse. Like, it's really crazy that it turned out the way it did. And, like, there's all these different avenues they could have gone. And this is not the only film. There's many, many, like, you hear all these, like, with Predator itself. I know you don't like Predator, but Predator, they had the terrible suit with Jean-Claude Van Damme in the jungle. And you're like, well, what if that movie was that? Or, you know, or if they had cast, Harrison Ford was not going to be Han Solo at first. It was going to be Burt Reynolds. And you're like, what if Burt Reynolds was Han Solo? What would Star Wars be? Would Star Wars even exist? Like, it's all those things. And RoboCop, the same stories were emerging as I was reading through the background of this. I'm like, how did this movie become this very particular shape where it is, on surface level, an action movie where it's a robot cop gunning down a bunch of bad guys? And then there's also this satire and critique of America, of capitalism, of corporations, of police force, of, like, it's just, and of even kind of consumerism, even to a certain extent. That's kind of a minor thing in this, but it's still there. How did it turn into that? And it's really fascinating to me. Like, it could have been so many other things, but instead it occupies this unique shape. And I don't know, Paul Verhoeven, he's a lunatic. That's what everyone says.
I want that put on my tombstone. I hope that, like, here lies Andrew Bloom, comma, a lunatic.
I mean, that's,
but everyone, he was our lunatic.
Everyone says Paul Verhoeven is a nutcase and is impossible to work with, but he made really good movies that were really good until they stopped being really good, or until he retired. I think he just quit eventually. But I mean, he made tons of, like, I think RoboCop's great. I love Starship Troopers, even though I have a feeling that I remember some vaguely remember you not liking Starship Troopers, which I love.
I like it well enough. I just don't love it.
I love Starship Troopers, but I'm not as high on Total Recall. But I mean, I like Showgirls for how terrible it is.
See, that's funny because I actually did like Total Recall a decent amount and was not expecting to. Was kind of expecting to hate it. So
why? Because of Arnold? Is that why?
I think I recently just watched The Terminator and did not care for that. And so it was sort of like, well, okay, I know. Ask me out of the circle.
You can't, like, it's The Terminator.
James Cameron and me are not on the same wavelength.
His masterpiece, Avatar.
I think you're referring to The Last Airbender, and I'm pretty sure M. Night Shyamalan directed that one.
Oh, yes, of course. That's what I think about when I think of Avatar The Last Airbender. I think of the M. Night Shyamalan disaster. I don't think of that, the nearly perfect animated show. I don't know where to start about RoboCop, Andrew. There's so much in it that I don't know how to talk about it. Like, I don't know where to go in. Like, it has so much. There's so much in it. It's so much depth to it.
It is a very dense film. There's a lot going on, and I think that's probably why I say, having only seen it once, it would be a rewarding film to go back and watch again. It does feel like there is a lot packed in there into what is a frankly pretty tight hour and 40-minute runtime to begin with. But maybe a good place to start, tell me if you feel otherwise, is asking a question, Robbie. What do you think the ultimate message of this film is? What do you think at the end of the day it is trying to say?
It's a good question. Theme is always a good place to start. And sometimes circle back around on an end. But I think that it's... I think ultimately it is about reclaiming... Like, I think it says a lot of things about a lot of, I already mentioned, like, all the different things that it touches on. But I feel like, ultimately, you have to come back to Murphy. You have to come back to RoboCop himself. You have to come back to, he is, and I think everything else spirals out of him and the journey that he goes on this film. It's very simple, but that's kind of, I think, why it works so well. Is, you have a cop who is a gunslinger. You know, we don't get to know the human Murphy very much. You know, he shows up in a embattled district of Detroit, and he seems like a normal guy. He has a kid and a wife. His kid, like, he practices. You see him practicing his like gun draw.
TJ Laser.
Yep, TJ Laser. Really good. I love all the fake TV shows and the fake news reports. All of them are perfect. They are perfect. They are the best. you see, he's a gunslinger, and he seems like a decent guy. You don't really know a lot about him, but you know that he's trying to be the hero that his son wants him to be. You know, I think that's the first and biggest thing we get from human Murphy before he is obliterated with shotguns, which is in an incredibly upsetting scene.
Pretty viscerally unpleasant.
It's really awful. Like, I've seen this movie dozens of times. It never bothers me when they blow off at first. Like, terrible Clarence Boddicker. Oh my god, I love Clarence Boddicker. He's the worst. Kurtwood Smith. Most people know him as Red from that 70s show, but I love him, and he's the best as this awful, awful person. Just hate him. He's just unrepentant, terrible person. Just wants, I loves being a criminal. And that's all that gang. Everyone in that gang, they love doing crimes. They just love it. That's their favorite.
They are gleefully odious.
They cackle and they laugh as they're blown apart per Murphy. They blow off his hand. They bombard him with shotgun shells. And then finally Clarence pops him in the head. And then we go on. The rest of this movie is him, like, us following him along on his journey of reclaiming his humanity to a certain extent, and realizing what can he be, how he fits into this machine that he is a part of, not just the machinery that is built into him, but the machinery of being a cop and being a tool of this giant corporation, effectively. And then at the end, reclaiming his name. You know, what's your name? Murphy. And I think ultimately it's that simple. It's a man reclaiming his self, reclaiming his name, and deciding what it means.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And at the same time, I think one of the things that makes the movie work, at least for me, is that it uses him as a symbol for the city writ large. That I feel like there's a big dichotomy here between dehumanization and corruption on the one hand from OCP, or pardon me, OCP, OCB, something like whatever the big evil corporation is.
OCP. Come on, Andrew. OCP. Absolutely.
And you have them on the one hand who are a corrupting force, who are a dehumanizing force. And then you have the push and pull of Murphy, who kind of becomes this one-man army, less for defending the city as a whole, though obviously that's a part of what he does, but also just for restoring the importance of the human soul in some way, shape, or form. Like, I think so much of what you see from the bad guys in this film is about taking away from the humanity of things. Whether that is Murphy himself, when they turn him into a piece of quote-unquote product, whether it is in the police force, where they are doing everything they can to diminish the role of the actual flesh-and-blood police officers and their judgment, and from the city itself, replacing public services and public goods with as much privatization and as much rent-seeking as possible. And I think so much of the movie is about how so much of what the company does and what these various forces do is to try to stamp out the humanity. And Murphy is the symbol for how it can't be stamped out in some way. He does reclaim his identity, but he's also a peon to the idea that the human soul breaks through everything that is happening out here. I think that makes it a big, important point for what the movie is going for.
I mean, it all spirals out from that. You know, it is all, everything else the film is doing, it spirals out from him reclaiming that. Them trying to make him from a figurative machine of this corporation as a cop into a literal machine. And the presentation, how it's all shown is incredible. The way we see him die, we see Murphy die, and they reference Psycho. I think one of the writers references Psycho about how I can't remember the actress's name. Janet Leigh, wife, mother of Jamie Lee Curtis. But Janet Leigh, they reference Psycho and how Janet Leigh, Marion Crane, the character, is. You know, when they were marketing Psycho, it's Janet Leigh. She's the big actress. She's the big star. And yet she dies in the first act. And the movie shifts into something else. And you're presented Murphy as, oh, he is this, you know, this blue-collar guy. He's John McClane to a certain extent, you know. And then he dies, right? Like, 10 minutes into the movie. Gets blown away, obliterated. And then, and we get, there's that, like, the scene of the ER. Where they try and bring him back to life, even though it's a lost cause. Like, I just saw what they did to him. That dude is dead. But they try and bring him back anyway. And we reboot. We see him come online for the first time from his perspective. It's kind of that Terminator perspective to a certain extent.
Yeah. I think that's one of the smartest moves that that the movie makes. It uses a lot of point of view shots. And for a character who is, by definition, not very expressive, kind of reserved, it helps humanize him. It helps make you empathize with him when you're literally seeing things from behind his eyes.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, the empathy, it delivers, it kind of tells the audience how we should feel with Lewis. She's a lot of the time the kind of the way that communicates, like, oh, Lewis cares. She's like, you're Murphy. That's who you are. What happened? Like, and she's like trying to, her kindness, and like, she's never really, like, she doesn't ever act scared around him. She's always like trying to be, she's like, wait a minute, you're not RoboCop. You're a man in there somewhere. I know you are. What happened to you? And all that, like, we get because the suit is so big and because you only really see like the lower third of Peter Weller's face, you see his mouth for the most, mouth and chin. That's all you get for the most part until like the third act. You have to, it is smartly goes like, well, here's perspective from RoboCop, RoboCop's eyes. We get Lewis kind of questioning like, who are you? What is going on? Concern about him. And then we get, you know, effectively, like, we see, I don't know, we also get empathy just because RoboCop's, he saves people. We see multiple scenes with him doing the good thing, saving people.
So maybe this is just putting my modern values onto a film from 1987, but I don't know that I necessarily had a lot of empathy for him in those scenes because, A, he is extraordinarily brutal in a way that seems disproportionate at times. And B, you know, it's not as though he expresses genuine concern for the people who are being robbed or assaulted. It just seems very much like, you know, you have the moment like, I will take you to a rape crisis center. He's still this cold automaton. And it's not until later when he's going after people because he's motivated by his own feelings, his own experiences, that I think you start to get more of that humanity in him. If anything, I found the early scenes where he's saving people oddly chilling in their own way.
Well, I mean, I think, well, there is absolutely the interpretation, like the criminals, there is a, have you seen any of the Death Wish movies, the old ones with Charles Bronson?
I have not, but I am aware of them, if for no other reason than through homage from The Simpsons.
Yes. I mean, they are, but I mean, this is taking a lot from Judge Dredd. Like, the aesthetics is a lot of, it's very Judge Dredd, which is the comic book that was out then and influenced everything.
And didn't they initially market it, or at least float it, as Dirty Harry with gears or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that there, but Dirty Harry and Death Wish. Those are yes, hero cop.
We need to clean up the street, especially of people of color, because that's what middle America is afraid of right now.
Well, I mean, this movie is not, I don't know, this, I include RoboCop from a lot of, like, because I feel like a lot of this is operating on, like, four different levels, so I'm not going to say, like, oh, no, it's definitely in saying that the city is full of criminals. It's also talking about how the fact, like, everyone has no money and everyone's afraid, and, like, there's a lot of, I think, institutional things happening and corruption, and the corporations obviously behind a lot of this, so I want to say, like, that the RoboCop is smart. This movie is smart enough that, to know that it is kind of presenting, like, yes, look, here are these movie creep. Like, there's in Death Wish 3, they call all the criminals in Death Wish 3 creeps. They're not real life criminals. They don't represent real life people. It's not like you watch The Wire and there are quote unquote criminals in The Wire, but they're people. They're full people where you empathize with and you understand why they are forced into this life. In Death Wish, none of that, they're creeps. They're criminals. You kill them. You shoot them. They're bad guys. They have no character. They have no depth. There's no reasons. They're just mean and terrible. That's all the reason they commit crimes.
They were born bad.
They were born bad. And that's, like, this whole movie has that kind of aesthetic. Like, you look at Boddicker's gang, those guys are creeps. They are not, like, normal, like, fully fledged criminals. They love to murder, and they love to sell drugs, and they're terrible, and they'll kill you, and they laugh at you. They're not real people. And to be fair, the people we see RoboCop stop early on, before we get more of his character fleshed out, when he starts, you know, when he goes back to his house, this is really the first sign of things. When he hears his name for the first time, when Lewis tells him, he's like, Murphy, and he's like, he has this dream, and he goes out.
Why did you say that name?
My mother's name was Martha. my mother's name was Murphy. Before all that happens, the criminals he stops are like, hey, it's a rapist. Like, I don't care. Shoots a rapist in the crotch, like, whatever. Oh yeah, don't rape people.
I mean, sure, okay. I don't know that I need to say this. I'm not defending the rapist, but I also feel like the movie, and maybe I'm giving Verhoeven too much credit, but I feel like this is true in his other work as well, that he does want you to think of RoboCop as out there and doing some good and protecting people, but also wants you to question his methods, because he is a tool of people who do not care about the humanity of the people that they are quote unquote protecting, or the people they are quote unquote arresting or taking care of, that they are just out there for purely, I don't want to say malevolent, but maybe malevolent, just entire lucrative purposes. I think they mean to cut a contrast between how a real life police officer and a, you know, mechanized automaton of a police officer would deal with these situations. I think he wants to flatten the nuance, not just because it makes for some cool action scenes. And look, it is cool to see that guy, to see RoboCop shoot through that woman's dress and puncture that guy in the groin. Like, I'm not going to deny there is a base level atavistic blood pumping quality to it. But I also think Verhoeven wants you to recoil from it somewhat. I think that is at least part of the goal here.
Well, I mean, I think that, but that's what I was coming back around to, is that, like, yeah, it is gruesome and very, this movie is very, very violent. Like all of Verhoeven's movies, they're full of violence, and it took a lot. They had to edit this thing down a lot to get an R rating, just so it wouldn't be an X or NC-17 or whatever it was in 87. I forget if they had NC-17 by then. But
I think it was still X at that time.
Okay. Well, they had to edit it down a lot, the violence. And that's the thing. Like, you hear a lot about movies getting, they have to edit a lot of sex or nudity because of how the MPAA works, but not a lot of violence. So most of the time, the violence is the thing they don't care about. If it's an R, like, oh yeah, it's an R, let it be super bloody, who cares? But they had to edit a lot of violence out, and it is very brutal and it is jarring. But you go back to that the attempted rape scene with the random woman, and the way she runs to him and tries to hug him, and she can't even wrap her arms around him. He's so big. He's so bulky. You see this fragile woman, this victim, right next to him. And look at the way this is a person. This is a human. They're frail and vulnerable. And this machine, this is a monster. This isn't human. He's not human anymore. But I don't, maybe it's because I've seen the movie so many times. That just makes me kind of empathize with him more in a certain way. Like, it makes me look what they did to this man. This guy, he was human at one point, and now he's this.
True to your monster point, there's a certain King Kong type imagery to it. And I think that's a similar goal of that movie, is that they want you to see the humanity in this person or in this creature, even though they have been turned into this thing by some other entity or organization that has different plans for it.
And so that, I mean, like, it's not like it's actually telling you anything about what's going on inside Murphy's head or RoboCop's head. You're not really getting any of that. It's all surface, but it feels like I empathize mostly just because it's so stark. It's so stark that he is this machine, this merciless, like, dead or alive, you're coming with me. The way he says that, like, it's only that movie, that line is said literally twice in the movie. It is his catchphrase, but he barely says it. And he says it once as a human, and it's him mimicking TJ Laser. It's him mimicking that gunslinger television show mentality. But as RoboCop, it is just in memory. There's nothing. It's not. It doesn't mean anything yet, at least to him. You were going to say something.
Having watched the show, or pardon me, watched the movie for the first time, I did not know that was his catchphrase. It wasn't until I was reading about it later that I took it away that that was the point of it. Because it's a cool phrase, and it echoes in an interesting way from when he's a human to when he is RoboCop. But I had no clue that that became his tagline going forward.
I mean, yeah, RoboCop doesn't talk a lot. What is he gonna? How many lines does RoboCop have in the rest in the movie?
He gets a decent amount once he hooks up with Lewis again and takes off the mask. But even then, he is particularly taciturn. He's not exactly loquacious. Like, time for me to go on a 3-minute monologue about the plight of man and humanity.
No, he doesn't say a lot. So that when, like, that is the dead or alive, you're coming with me thing. That is a thing that kind of, I think that is the thing that it's attached to RoboCop, of anything. Like, of all the things he says, that's the thing. It has some poetry to it, and it has that the echo of him when he was a human, and then saying as a robot or a cyborg.
It would look cool on a t-shirt.
I would, like I said, I'll take if you can get me a RoboCop t-shirt from 1987, I will happily I would like that. I unironically, like, I think, like Predator and like Die Hard, like a lot of these action movies from the 80s, especially this movie, which is way, way more heavy on satire and kind of deconstruction of a lot of, I don't know, societal constructs. I didn't really get that when I was younger and watching this movie. I also probably watched this movie way too young. I was way too young to watch RoboCop. It's so violent. I watched it anyway. Who cares? I was like probably eight. I was probably eight when I watched this movie. It's not a good idea.
That is pretty early to watch a movie with as much violence and heavy themes as this one has.
I turned out great, Andrew. Don't worry about it. Show every 8-year old RoboCop. They'll turn out just like me and be great and perfect.
We should have a second grade unit on RoboCop in every elementary school.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to watch it 5 times in a row.
Okay.
I don't.
You're tough but fair.
Yes, exactly.
Like RoboCop himself.
But I don't know, that those early scenes are not nearly, there's not nearly as much. I think it is repeated viewings, like, because of already I feel so much about the film as a whole that I start gleaning more from them than I would if I just watched it for the first time, like you have. I feel like it's because I know I have that knowledge of later in the film. I have that knowledge of what Murphy is under there somewhere. I have, like, it's just, it's everything in the movie effectively is this push and pull of like, well, how, like, oh, I feel empathy for Murphy and for RoboCop, but also he's this brutal cop. You know, he's just like, he doesn't kill. I mean, I guess he throws that town council guy at the window and he dies, but he doesn't kill the rapist. He shoots him in the groin. He doesn't kill the armed robber. He just clotheslines him, knocks him unconscious, I guess.
I mean, they may not be dead, but they are not going to have a good time after that.
I mean, again, it operates in a weird sort of cartoon logic in a certain extent. Like, it's really weird that way where it can, and I think the ultra violence is like, active, it actually helps in that situation because it is like this, oh, he just clotheslined him, he's fine. It's like, no, he's not fine. He's definitely not fine. These people are not fine. But if it's very much like this, that Judge Dredd, that the where Judge Dredd is also ironically showing you this brutal fascist cop versus like movies like Death Wish where that is, there's no irony. Charles Bronson is a good guy and he shoots bad guys. All the people who get killed are bad and they deserve to die. And I think that there is a purpose to that early brutality because he is a machine. He is part of this machine. And it's not until he hasn't quite awakened yet.
Yeah, it's not an indictment of Murphy. It's an indictment of what OCP has made of him. And I think that's part of the tragedy of it, is you see him turn into a vessel for these things that it doesn't necessarily seem like flesh and blood Murphy would do or that any cop would do in this scenario. And I think that's part of what makes him feel real as a character in a lot of ways.
But we see him awaken. You know, he slowly awakens. He has the dreams. There's still there. They didn't, whatever they did to him, it did not erase everything. There's still memories in there. There's still the idea. There's still the vague sense of him, of Murphy, in that shell. And you see him slowly wake up. You see him go after the gang of Clarence Boddicker. And you see him. There's every scene I could talk about and just and opine about it. I just love, like, every scene of this movie. I love it. I love every scene. The scene where he goes back to his house. I love it because
it has a sort of slow spun melancholy to it. And I connected it with, well, I think it's rightfully the turning point of the movie because it speaks to this sense of him experiencing his old life again, of the reawakening of his moments as a human being popping back up into his brain. And it's so tragic. It's such a well-edited scene. The way that they cut back and forth between the emptiness of the present and the way that this has been sanitized through the talking head that tells you about the place that he's visiting as though he's trying to sell the home. But you also see the haste in which it was left, that it was a memory of Murphy himself and his family felt the need to leave because of too much there. And the way it jumps back and forth between the warm past and this cold, sterile present, it sells the transition between what Murphy was and what he is now better than anything else in the movie, because and it's important because you're right. At the very beginning, you don't get that much of Murphy pre-robotization. He is pretty much just a generic cop, and you see a little bit he wants to be a good guy for his son, but you don't get a great sense of who he is before this happened until you get to that scene and you see and feel, more importantly, what he lost while this was going on.
And I love the fact that we never see he never meets his wife or child again. They're gone. Like, even later in the later scene with Lewis, he's like, what happened to Murphy's? Like, he's still not Murphy by the time he's talking to Lewis later on in the baby food scene. But he's like, where did they go? Where are they? And she's like, she started over. Like, like you see Lewis have this moment where she's like hesitating. Like, maybe she does know where she is, where her Murphy's wife and child are. But she's like, she decides not to say. She's like, she moved on. She started over. You're dead. And it's very much like, yeah, there is no, like, it makes that, I don't know, it makes the decision to be Murphy again even more stark. It's not about your life. It's not necessarily about that life you left behind. It's not about your wife or child. It is about you. It's about that of just being human again. It is not you and your life. You may remember them, and they may inform everything you decide to do. But if you're going to move forward and be Murphy again, it can't matter. That can't affect your decision. It's just about, like, it's certainly like stark cold memory of them, but they're gone.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think he is still motivated by them. I think there is the pursuit of, if not them specifically, then at least he needs to take this step in his life to make it possible for him to go find them. And, you know, I haven't seen RoboCop 2 or 3 or the remake or anything like that. I don't know what happens in the future. But I have to imagine that any chapter of this story that goes forward in a meaningful way has to grapple with the fact that the thing that awakens him, the thing that does seem to drive him, is his connection to his family. I think, at least as I read it, and at least as I experienced it, that may be someplace off in the future, but I don't think he has a choice. I don't think he does it just for himself or just for any reason. I think he is compelled by these things that can't be erased in him, that can't be silenced in him, that he has to pursue whether he wants to or not.
I think it's just cleaner, ultimately, too. Like, I like the idea that, like, oh, well, no, there's not... Yeah, you had a wife and a child, but they're gone. And I don't know if they're in RoboCop 2, they do see each other again.
Okay.
RoboCop 2 is not as good as maybe, but it's worth watching. RoboCop 3 is utterly terrible. I have not seen the remake and I don't plan on it. I understand that it's entirely different. It's a different thing. It's not trying to, it's a remake, but it's very different than what this is, but it's just like a Total Recall remake. I don't care. I don't want to see that. I have no interest in a PG-13 version of Paul Verhoeven movies. I like Paul Verhoeven and the fact he made a bunch of R-rated movies that are unpleasant to watch. I don't want things that are PG-13. Like these ideas, just water it down a little bit and then we'll re-release it. I'm like, oh, no thanks, pass. I like that he only has his memories of his wife and his child. There's nothing else. They're not real. They're only his memories. But then out of that, and like that's when we first see his real emotion. We see emotion from RoboCop for the first time too. The scene in his house, he gets angry. He blows up. Breaks the television with the guy trying to sell him his house back.
And I think that draws a contrast with the earlier scenes when he's facing off with that robber or with the rapist or the crazy town councilman or whatever. I forget what his official title is. But there's something clinical about him in those moments. And I think it leads to why they are those, at least for me, those moments were chilling in some way, shape, or form. But here, he's losing control, which is scary in its own way, but again, also something very human about him in those moments.
I mean, I think that's the, it's, it is, it, I, it, that's, it's how the film ramps up that humanity and like you see more and more and more of his. You see him angry. You see him vengeful. You see him vulnerable. Like you, it's slowly amps back up to being closer to what Murphy is, where he is. Like those early scenes as a cop too, he's invincible. He gets peppered with gunfire and he's fine, like nothing hurts him, and he's cold and he's just like by the book. And then you start seeing him, his memories come back, and you start seeing him become the humanity. It's not even necessarily he's reclaiming it actively, but it's coming back to him, and it's passively creating. He's like, oh, he's angry now. Now he wants to get revenge on Boddicker.
It's erupting in him. And I think that's why I push back at least a little bit on the idea that it's a choice, because I think he does make the choice to go after some of these people, but I don't think he gets a choice as to whether or not he becomes human again. It's just something that the process was not able to erase and that he has to deal with, whether he wants to do that or not.
I'm going to put a pin on that until we get to the last scene in the movie, Andrew.
All right.
But then we should talk about OCP.
And you know me.
I was really hoping we could get through this podcast without that, but I guess that's impossible. That was not ever.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know me. Nothing is impossible with me.
I do know.
Transcend that. Possibilities, Robbie.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Nothing is impossible. Kevin Garnett, something. Because this is what we get ramped up to RoboCop uncovering all this crime, this conspiracy by OCP, and him confronting one of the best. I love Dick Jones. It's such a good name for this evil corporate guy. It's so good.
They all have kind of generic names.
They do. I love Dick Jones. And he's like, oh, I'm part of this machine. And we see that OCP is like, we kind of, there's throughout this RoboCop stuff, we've been following the OCP stuff as it went. You know, it's like we cut to Bob Morton. And his like little feud within the corporate structure of it's very like Wolf of Wall Street kind of ideas even Wall
American Street. Psycho.
Yeah. Like it's all, yeah. Corporate, you know, 80 Reaganomics, Reagan corporation stuff going on. And nothing to do with it. Seems like RoboCop is ostensibly connected to RoboCop because it's their program. But you're like, why? I am so far removed from my first viewing of this. I have no idea what it's like. Do you get an understanding of like why we're following all this corporate stuff while you're watching the movie for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it seemed relevant because let's put it this way. It's hard to separate the fact that I knew from cultural osmosis that at some point RoboCop becomes good, that he's not the villain of this movie. And it seemed pretty obvious from the early parts that the people who were doing this were the villains, that OCP were the ultimate villains, even though or at least were connected in some way, if not through conspiracy, then through mutual need and necessity, were connected with Boddicker's crew. So it seemed like we were spending time with them, if only to understand who the real bad guys are here. And it's funny, I don't know, I've been watching a lot of Batman the Animated Series lately, and one of the moves that show loves to make is it introduces some kind of colorful villain who is malevolent and cackling and very much a, you know, traditional superhero villain, but then it would almost always introduce some kind of corporate accessory who is even worse than them, just less colorful or less, you know, shall we say, theatrical in the streets when they're doing it. So it was pretty easy for me to read, based on that priming, that these were going to be people who, through hook or crook, antagonizing RoboCop in some way, shape, or form.
I mean, it is the big bad. It is the, oh, it's Clarence Boddicker is like a scumbag, and you hate him, but he's not in charge.
He's not the mastermind.
No, he is
not the cause of all this. He is a symptom of it.
Right. He is just another. He is simply a pawn controlled by Dick Jones, who is theoretically like, oh yeah, clean corporate man. I'm a vice president of this company. I'm number two, and I, you know, OCP. We just want to have business, create jobs, Delta City.
I mean, they open with him accidentally killing a dude. I guess there's no point in which you're like, yep, this is just a regular corporation doing regular things. Oh no, they're evil. Like they're from the very beginning. And maybe I'm looking at it through modern eyes. Maybe this was still in the Wall Street greed is good era where you could misconstrue these folks as just titans of industry. But I feel like you pretty immediately read them as scumbags. Like, you know, Dick Jones shoots the guy and seems much more concerned about the fact that his project isn't going well than about the fact that it just offed a dude. And one of the first things you see of Bob is the perspective shot of RoboCop where he's like, lose the arm. He doesn't need the arm. He's clearly callous. I mean, you know, again, I am coming to this movie after decades and decades of films that were influenced by RoboCop and inspired by RoboCop. You know, my first thought in watching that scene was District 9 and the way that, you know, there's a similar transformation at the core there and how it is corporatized and done with complete callousness for the humanity of the people involved. I guess I was never really under any misconception from almost the beginning of the movie that these were good or even half decent folk who weren't going to come at least be a thorn in the side of RoboCop sooner or later.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to imply, Andrew, that you wouldn't think these people are evil and terrible. From the get-go, it's very clear that these are terrible monsters. To a cartoonish degree, to a certain, they literally just watch a guy get exploded with heavy caliber machine gun fire from their robot, and they're like, oh man, robot's broken. Man, I wanted to sell that robot. It's too bad.
Could have been killing the right people.
I wanted to sell this to the military so I could replace the parts for 25 years and have a giant contract and make billions of dollars while it went into different foreign countries and killed people. It's not that they're villainous. It's more about, like, how does this connect back to RoboCop? How does it connect back to how RoboCop comes into being and how RoboCop exists? And, like, you know, there is... because it circles back around to RoboCop confronting Dick Jones, and we find his hidden fourth rule, where he can't arrest people who work for OCP. And then you get RoboCop hunted. And one of my favorite shots from any movie ever, him crawling on the ground as all his former police, associates or they're his brothers,
colleagues,
yeah, all of them just gun him down because they're told to. Because OCP told him, hey, he's a monster, kill him. They wipe him off the face of the earth. And you have, and the music soaring, I love the score, by the way. I love the simple score. I love it. I still remember, I hear it in my head. Like every time I watch the film, I keep it. It's like it spirals in my head, echoes in my head for a couple of days because I love it so much. But him crawling on the ground as he just like in silhouette as all these just machine guns and shotguns unloading on him, and you see him hurt for the first time. You see him wounded. You know, Ed 209 hurts him a little bit, and then you see all these cops shooting him, and he's hurt. He's just like holes popping in this armor, which until then he was invincible. You're like, oh, you can't hurt RoboCop, and then you're like, oh wait, no, you can. 100 people are shooting at him all at once. Yeah. Oh, something will. He can't survive that.
And it's necessary from a plot mechanic standpoint. Like it's obviously useful to character because it makes him vulnerable. And if we see something as vulnerable, we relate to it in some way, shape, or form. But it also creates stakes for when you're having the big blasting action scenes later in the movie because it lets you know that RoboCop can be wounded. He can be defeated. This isn't just the invincible guy going against the fleshy, spongy people who are inevitably going to lose on that account.
Yeah, and this is also the scene where it makes it like we up until this point, you get like reminders like OCP runs the cops, you know, and then but most of the time we spend with the cops is ground level. We have like the sergeant, the surly sergeant. We have Lewis. We have Murphy. We have the short locker room scene. But and you get all this news about cops getting killed out in the streets. But it's not really like it's you're like, oh, yeah, OCP runs the cops. But the, and the cops are trying to they're going to strike. There's a threat of a strike going on. There's like, you know, all these little tiny things hovering around the periphery. But it's never made. I think it's never demonstrated like, oh, how much control OCP actually has over the police force. And it's this scene in particular where it ties in here. Here's our protagonist. He has found the source of this corruption. He's trying to root it out. And it is demonstrated concretely. OCP does run the cops. OCP, the cops are OCP. This giant corporation, they are concretely connected to the police force. And it is shown on screen in an action movie in 1987. A policeman tries to root out corruption within the force, and they target him for destruction.
By the way, one thing I did want to note about this movie is that I appreciate that it is a product of its time and that, you know, you can connect to these issues in 1987, but that there's no purchase or relevance to them today, that we can safely have closed the book on this era and enjoy our modern era where everybody is totally okay with modern policing and you know, corporate influence on public life.
It's not a coincidence we're talking about RoboCop right now, Andrew. It's still relevant. It's still super relevant. 2020. It is 2020. It's still super relevant. Even more relevant, honestly. It is more. This is everything that happens in this movie is still like the news reports. The cat, like these smiling, happy anchors, like, oh yes, a space laser misfired today. 183 people are dead, including two former U.S. presidents. Over to you, Bill.
But not coincidentally, I think it's kind of implied that those two presidents are Nixon and Reagan. I mean, they're the ones who lived in California at the time.
Yeah, I mean, they never give us a year when this film is taking place. It's just the future. From the 1987 future, you know, who knows what actual year it's supposed to take place in, but yes, it is. There's a lot of things like that, but it is still like, oh yeah, and there's just these casual news reports of like, oh yeah, war in Mexico today, 300,000 people dead, and you're like, and they're like, all right, over to sports, and you're like, oh god, this is, this is how callous people, they're just terrible, they don't care.
Well, and one of the things I think makes the movie still resonant today is that it's not just the future, it's kind of abstracted, it's kind of caricatured. When one of the things Verhoeven does is he mixes that 80s cartoonishness with a certain 70s grittiness and produces something really unique as a combination of those two. And when you put those things together, it puts it at a remove from reality in a way that lets it kind of float onto whatever the issues of the day are. And I look, to be serious, I would love it if this had no relevance whatsoever to our modern day practices in public life. But the reality is one of the things that makes it applicable is not just its themes, but the way that the movie is built to be somewhat abstracted from the particular moment of 1987, even though it still speaks to that, obviously.
Yeah, it's not dated. There is no, it's not, I don't look, I, that's the other thing that I, why I don't really won't care about that remake is like, if you're remaking something that's clearly dated and clearly if you update it and recontextualize it, it could be really interesting. Like that'd be good. And like, you could do that with RoboCop, I guess, but 1987 RoboCop still works. It's still this, it doesn't, the movie hasn't changed. Like everything in it is still applicable to today. There's no, it's not, it doesn't feel like a movie that's corny. It feels like a movie that's felt like it could have been made yesterday, except for maybe a couple effect shots, which are largely, the effects are largely great. There's just like one or two nitpicky things. Speaking of effects, Because then we get to RoboCop removing the helmet. Again, I just love it. I just love this scene, the baby food scene. Mwah. I just, ugh. It's gross. The head is, the way, like, I read all these stories about how, there was this big arguments from Rob Bottin, who did the effects, makeup effects, which Rob Bottin also did effects for The Thing, which, again, my favorite movie.
Doesn't endear him to you at all.
No, but there was arguments about between him and Verhaeven about how we can like this, you know, like I don't want the seams to show, you know, I don't want it to look fake. I want the illusion to stay. And it looks artificial, but it's supposed to, it's like weird flesh melding into metal. It's gross. It's still upsetting. Like you finally see Murphy's face again after like an hour plus of the movie. You're like, oh, Murphy. Oh, wait, your face is now like the whole back of your head. It's just a big computer chip. Ugh, gross.
It's Uncanny Valley, but in a way that works for the purposes of the movie. Yeah. Uses that. It doesn't just stumble backwards into it.
No, it's great, and it just reemphasizes, and like there's even that bit of self-awareness where he tells Lewis, like, you might not like what you're about to see, and like it is that, I don't know, the film juggles this tenuous line of he's a monster and he's a hero, he's super violent but he's also extremely sad, like there's all these this dissonance working in concert, and it's really impressive, and it always impresses me every time I watch the movie. And you see him shooting baby food. He has to line up his shot again, killing those poor babies.
Well, I think it's worth noting when we talk about the face removal scene or the face plate removal scene, that the editing and shot selection in the movie is so good because it builds up to moments like that. The first time you see RoboCop, you don't see him clearly. You see these glimpses of him from afar. And so when you do finally see him head on, it has impact. When you see RoboCop with his face mask off, it doesn't just jump directly to it. It doesn't just, boom, okay, here we go. You kind of see him from the side. You see reactions. You see shadows. And then, boom, you get the actual full-on shot. Verhoeven and his editor and his cinematographer know how to position this for maximum impact. And it's one of the vital tools of the movie and the language of the movie.
Yeah, it is like Verhoeven is extremely good at, I don't know, the segmenting off of our perspective and controlling exactly what he wants us to see and making sure that it is measured. It's also, I think, a good time to talk about RoboCop's the actual design of the suit, of how Peter Weller moves in the suit, like the distinct kind of movement RoboCop has, where it could easily fall into something really silly, but it never does. There's always a certain gravitas to it, and the clunky suit just kind of makes it, like I said earlier, it just makes him look like more of a monster, less human to a certain extent.
I will admit, I like the RoboCop suit. I think it's iconic. It does feel like one of the things that is a bit dated about the film. You know, when you compare it to something that, you know, the various superhero costumes you see today, it feels like spray-painted plastic, I guess. And then, you know, it works. It's the aesthetic for the movie in a lot of ways. And it has an exaggerated aesthetic. I think it works for what Verhoeven is going for. But it doesn't look terribly realistic, I guess. Not that it needs to, but that it's not necessarily going for that either.
Well, I'm going to tell you a secret, Andrew. It's not a secret.
What's your secret, Robbie?
My secret? It's not a secret. I don't like most modern superhero designs. I think they're all mostly terrible. So I like... I don't know. I like the clunkiness. It is clunky, but I like it. I like the clunkiness. This is their plan B. RoboCop is plan B. He's not, this was never, they wanted Ed 209 to be their their main robot. They didn't want RoboCop. They didn't want a real human in there, or even part of a human in there. They just wanted all robot. And so I think, I don't know, I always read it like, yeah, it's sort of clunky and it looks kind of janky, is because this wasn't their initial plan. And they're like, oh, backup. We're going to take a what's left of a human and pop him into this metal shell and see what works. Oh, he doesn't need his arm. That's fine. There's kind of like a cold brutality to it.
I guess I just don't think it ever necessarily plays as real, which it doesn't have to. This movie is clearly not going, at least not going fully for realism. But it's tough for me to mentally separate the idea that this is a guy in a suit. And obviously, and not a guy who's been mangled into this robotic form. And I think the reason it works has a lot to do with Weller, that he is not somebody who gets to be very expressive with a lot of the tools most actors get to use. He can't use his face. His body language has to be very regimented because he's portraying a different kind of thing. But he uses that to imbue a combination of humanity and also mechanization with this guy. And I know he worked with a movement coach from Juilliard. He did other practices when they were getting the suit together to help make that work. But in terms of the design itself, you know, I guess I don't think it necessarily crosses the plausibility threshold, which it doesn't have to do. That's not the tone they're going for. But I don't know. It's unreal, which is suits the film's needs, but doesn't cross that threshold for me.
I don't. Well, have you ever? You haven't read The Meta Barons? That's a comic book, Andrew. I know you haven't.
I have not.
I'm curious if you would like the Meta Barons. I have a very love-hate relationship with the Meta Barons, but it is a Jodorowsky written comic book. It is insane, but there's a lot of mechanical beings in it. And this, I think there's, I would, my complaints about the Meta Barons and the design of the look of the book is none of my complaints. And this echoes that a lot. I think it is authoritarian. I don't like realism. I don't like, I think I view this a lot as kind of a weird superhero movie too, in that I don't really care if my superheroes look realistic. I don't care if they look like, well, no, Spider-Man runs around in his pajamas. Of course that's not going to, like, he'd get killed like 50 times over. I don't care what kind of powers he has. He's running around in cloth. Like, one time he gets slammed with Green Goblin's pumpkin bombs. He's going to get torn in half by shrapnel. Like, I know it's not real. I don't care. Like, it doesn't take place in reality. And I kind of like the fact that it's so jarring. That is so unrealistic. It is. And like, it kind of echoes like everything else, like the aesthetic of the film, that kind of weird blue gray.
Exactly. It's internally consistent, and that's what makes it work.
It's shot a lot in Dallas. A lot of
what? Represent D-Town. No, it's so hey, I can contribute not firsthand but secondhand details here. I not very long ago I got to go to a live Q&A with Ray Weiss, who plays one of the members of Boddicker's gangs here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at a screening of the Twin Peaks movie in Dallas, and he talked a little bit about filming RoboCop here, and he gave me this tidbit: one of the reasons they ended up choosing to film in Dallas because the city of Dallas was very willing to let them blow major parts of the city up, which other cities apparently had their qualms about it. So for all of the unique Dallas landmarks that you can see in the background of this, my fellow Texans, you can thank Dallas's lax approach to demolition as the justification for it.
They do have a lot. They do blow up a lot of stuff in the movie. It's very good, frankly.
There was some old section of the city they were going to renovate anyway, and so they're like, yeah, sure, blow it up, whatever. Yeah,
shoot your powerful super rifles, whatever they are, your science fiction super rifles. Speaking of Ray Weiss, we should mention it, like, everyone in this movie is like that guy, you know. It's one of those guys. Yeah. Yep, Miguel Ferrer, Kurtwood Smith, Nancy Allen, even Peter Weller. Like, I feel like there's a lot of those. You're like, oh, it's that guy. Like, even Paul McCrane, the guy who turns into Melty Man.
Cool effect.
Yes. You see, like, all these actors, you recognize them from all these other things. You're like, oh, they're in that, and that, and that. And I don't know. It's a certain charm this movie has for me, too, is that just, like, everyone in it, there's no, like, I don't know. None of these people are famous or great actors. It's just they're not, none of them are, like, the super A-listers. There's no Bruce Willis in this. There's no Arnold Schwarzenegger. It is a bunch of, like, mostly working actors who have worked. I mean, all of them continue, for the most part, work till this very day, and are very good and great in this movie. It's just, it's kind of charming to me that it kind of, I think, matches the appeal of the film itself. And it's not Die Hard. It's not Predator. It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's not Commando. It's darker and it's lower to the ground. And it's not happy about the violence. Like, despite the fact that it is far more violent than either Predator or Die Hard, it is not trying to glorify the violence at all. In the end, I feel like the film is actively doing the opposite.
No, I agree. I think it does want you to recoil from it. But it's worth noting that Bruce Willis wasn't Bruce Willis when Die Hard came out.
But still, he's Bruce Willis now.
he was a working stiff on a sitcom. Like, you gotta give him some credit there. But I agree. Like, I think the fact that this is a movie built around character actors, not to put too fine a point on it, but gives it a lot of character. Not all of the players in the film have a great deal of depth to them, but they have personality, and that comes through in the kinds of folks that get cast here, and it helps make the movie work on a scene-to-scene basis.
It's just, and I don't know, it's just fun. I also hesitate to use the word fun. I think I described how the thing is fun at a certain point, too. But it's fun, the fact that, like, these are, I don't know, that everyone is really just going for it. Everyone is doing as much as they can. They're pushing it directly that they, like, I don't know if it's just the directing, like, how Verhoeven got what they wanted out of the actors. But, like, he knew how to get them just to that same kind of, that the line of satire where, like, they are over, like, they're chewing scenery at the right times to get to that tone, to make you understand, like, oh no, this is ridiculous, but it's also chilling. It has to be both at the same time.
It is certainly not a subtle movie.
No,
I don't mean that as a criticism. I think it uses its directness well, which not every, shall we say, blunt movie is capable of doing.
No, it is absolutely not subtle, which is the thing I love about it. I think subtlety is overrated for the most part. I'd rather you hit me over the head with a sledgehammer movie. Please, go ahead.
Well, I do not. I think subtlety is, if anything, underrated. And I also like this movie, which I think speaks to its quality. It can bring our bombastic and understated appreciation together.
Well, I mean, I think there is subtle things in the movie. I think there are a lot
That's true.
There's the thing I noticed in this for the first time. I've never noticed this before, Andrew. And that scene where the council member has hostages and he's already killed someone and has all these demands. And he's like, recount the votes. And if I lose, I want to win anyway. I want my old job back. But as he's yelling out at the hostage negotiator, the guy with the bullhorn, he's literally hiding behind a flag. He's literally hiding behind the United States flag as he's yelling. And I never noticed it before.
It's a choice.
Yeah. And it's not, it's like a 3 seconds long, that little bit. And then you're like, and it's cuts to a different shot, but you're like, oh yeah, I get it. All right.
And I think that's a big part of why the movie clicks for me is its tone is in no way subtle. It is very in your face. It is very over the top about everything it's doing. But despite that fact, there are layers to it. There are a lot of layers to pretty much everything that is going on, which gives it a richness that not every movie that writes it on the screen can muster.
So where were we were getting basically, I mean, like, it all culminates in effectively two scenes where the steel mill cat and mouse scene or sequence of scenes where they're trying to kill Murphy and he,
they work hard, they play hard.
I'd buy that for a dollar. It's taken us that long to say that, so I make that's an achievement because I love that stupid, terrible sitcom. That's, they keep coming back to on the screens again. I'd buy that for a dollar. Everyone thinks it's hilarious. Every single person who watches it, this fake, terrible sitcom, laughs so hard. They think it's so funny. And I don't know. It's just, it tickles me that they made up this terrible show within a show. And RoboCop definitely, he murders all those guys. They're all dead. With his, Andrew, what did you think about the data spike?
I thought it was cool. I like, again, this movie has good setups and payoffs. So you see him use it for the actual purpose the first time, and you see that it's got utility. But then him turning around and using it as a weapon, it's a nice wrinkle. It's a good call and response in some way for what happens earlier in the movie. And I think it also has symbolic resonance because it's kind of what he uses to find Boddicker in the first place. I like that a lot.
Okay. I mean, I love the data. Obviously. It's like, yeah, he stabs that dude in the throat and blood spurts out. It's great. Love it. The showdown.
It's poetic in its way.
Showdown with Boddicker. And the fact that, you know, he tells, you know, Lewis gets shot and he's like, they'll fix you. They fix everything. And then we get the showdown in the corporate. And, you know, there is that, it's a very lovely, it's just like a kind of very simple ending where, like, we get the showdown with Boddicker and his gang in the steel mill. And he's literally in the muck and this filthy water and covered in oil and blood. And then
he is no longer the pristine instrument of this corporation.
And he drives up to the skyscraper, blows up another Ed-209 with one of their sci-fi rifles, their boom guns, and then goes up to the corporation, and he's disgusting looking, covered in blood. He pulls out his own spike that is also covered in Boddicker's blood, demonstrates that Dick Jones is a conspirator of murder many, many times over. And one of my nitpicks is that puppet that they show Jones falling out of the skyscraper as he's plummeting. It's not great. It's my biggest complaint. It lasts for like 5 seconds, but still it's just like, that's not him. that's not that guy. That's a puppet or whatever, a dummy. But I put a pin in it about the rising humanity in Murphy, and it's the last line of the movie, and it's kind of perfect, honestly, perfect ending, where it's like, you know, the old man, which is that the president, that's all he's ever known as. They never give a name. He's just the old man. And he's like, what's your name? Murphy. And
arc complete.
And then boom, and literally end the movie.
It's satisfying. Like, it's simple, it's straightforward, but it does exactly what it needs to do.
It does.
It tells the audience exactly what they need to know about Murphy's journey, where he started, where he's been, and where he ends up.
No, I love it. Don't get me wrong. I hate long drag out endings. When you get like literally just movie, boom, we said what we wanted and we're done. Like, I love it. I love art that does, like, any kind of art that just does not have like 14 codas. I don't need all that. Like, you finish your stories. Stop while you're ahead.
So are we going to do Return of the King next? Is that the plan?
No. I already kind of did that. Me and Matt talked about the book.
Oh, it was the novel. The movie is different.
Yeah, it's better. I'll say that. The movie's better than... it doesn't have a weird... secondary plot in the Shire where we see... What's-his-face get killed by hobbits or whatever the hell happens to Saruman. Gets murdered by his own men or something. Like, it's weird. I don't... always struck me as so strange. Where that Tolkien decided to have that weird addendum when you're like, oh, just can't Saruman just have lost already? Like, he was always second banana anyway. Who cares? No, I love Murphy. And then boom, credits. roll. Credits roll. Dun 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 dun. It's perfect.
It's almost a smash cut.
It is. It really is. I'm just but I feel like that cements to me that certainly Murphy's emotions and his memories and his humanity, I don't think he makes a choice to he doesn't make a choice, oh, I am human. I think it is more about his choice that Murphy, when he says, I'm, you know, what's your name, Murphy, it feels very much like it is a culmination of a choice to not be a part of the greater machine. Not necessarily for him alone to be human. Like, I don't know if there's a choice there. Like, I feel like there is a certain amount of like, oh, I feel human, therefore I am. And I can't, there's no repressing that. But I feel like there is a choice in, no, I'm not going to sit by and accept corruption. I am not going to sit by and accept mistruth. I acknowledge the fact that I am not what I used to be. But I don't have to accept being a, like, I may have been turned into a machine to a certain extent, but I don't have to accept being part of a machine. I feel like there is a choice there.
I don't disagree necessarily. I think I'm probably splitting hairs at this point, but I would characterize it more as something akin to an awakening or an epiphany as to what he is. And, you know, letting there be some self-actualization in that. I just don't know how much control he has over it. And maybe what it is he regains his humanity, and so he regains his ability to choose. He regains his ability to think for himself and proceed accordingly. I guess I don't know if he has a choice as to what he is that he ever makes or accepts, but I think he has a choice as to what he does. And that definitely comes through in those final moments. Because he's been, you know, I think that's one of the things that confirms and cements his humanity in the movie. He can't work around his programming at all. He's still subject to it. But he knows enough how to finesse it, how to work the situation to where, yes, you're right, I cannot kill you, Dick Jones. It is against my programming. But I can certainly engineer this situation to where suddenly you are not an OCP executive anymore, and suddenly my programming makes you fair game. Like, there is at least some agency that he has reclaimed and is exercising in that closing moment. And I think you are right to seize on that.
And I think there is a certain acknowledgement of the fact that, you know, the old man is, like, I feel like that's, it's an interesting thing that I think that, like, that the film does do this. There is a thing that I waffle on a little bit, is the old man, you know, is he a force for good?
Probably not.
No.
Almost assuredly not.
Probably not. You know, he doesn't want Dick Jones around, but... And Dick Jones is, like, thoroughly evil, but there, and, you know, there is, and there's also the, you know, this, the implication of these, you know, these, the low level police force who, you know, they're trying their best in this untenable situation. And are they good guys? Not really, you know. It's hard to say, like, in this film, what does that mean? When the old man is still, like, RoboCop, all we know, again, is the story of Murphy. And Murphy doing the best to manipulate these systems so that he can best handle his self-realization. And deal with the, you know, what he views as corruption and problems. But I think that, I don't know, it's probably too much to ask for a movie from 1987 to tackle all these things. I think it already does a tremendous job at kind of touching upon all these different issues, especially an action movie that does all this stuff. But I feel like that is the only thing that kind of is left hanging for me, is the very fact that, like, the old man is not ever indicted for any of this. You know, there's never not even a hint throughout the film that the old man is responsible for. Well, he let Dick Jones just this master manipulator, and he let this guy rise in the ranks for decades, assumedly, and hasn't done anything about it. Dick Jones did all this stuff under his watch, and Delta City is, like, certainly under his control, and like there's all these terrible things going on. You're like, well, what about the old man?
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of want to put him in the realm of a good guy, or at least somebody who has admiration for RoboCop, putting him in the position of the audience. But clearly, if he is supervising this company, which is obviously doing some pretty terrible things, I don't know that it wants you to think he's a good guy.
Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, I think it's kind of like, this is the story. This is I'd rather it be this, where it's like, okay, like, arc realized, end credits, movie's over, than trying to like incorporate an even a different arc and add more. There's already a lot of things going on in RoboCop. I don't expect them to, like, at a certain point, you're like, oh, well, RoboCop's already kind of working through this system. And maybe, like, RoboCop 2 is not bad, but it's also, like, not necessary, and it does not ever get to that. Like, RoboCop 2 is a completely different, weird movie, written by Frank Miller.
Well, that's a selling point.
Mm.
No? Okay. Mm. All right. I mean, 1980s Frank Miller.
Hmm.
All right. Well, you are the expert. I will defer to you on that point.
I mean, Frank Miller works best when he's, I don't know, has a filter, an editor, someone. When he's collaborating with people. When you just get him alone, not as good. Especially after, yeah, the 80s Frank Miller is not so bad. RoboCop 2 is much more cheesy. It's more over the top, more corny, less satire. There's satire, but it's different types of satire. I don't know. It's a very strange movie. It's hard to explain, especially compared to this, where it's like, this is like kind of, Verhoeven does not return for any of the RoboCop, anything else attached to RoboCop the rest of his career. He moves on, because that's what he does. He just moves on to the next thing. Peter Weller has said, Peter Weller and Nancy Allen both appear in RoboCop 2. Peter Weller was not in RoboCop 3 only because he was doing Naked Lunch.
Okay, well, that's a pretty good excuse. I'm not saying it turned out. I'm saying it was, you know, it's a reasonable choice.
It's, Naked Lunch is a movie. It's a one I can't, I don't know. I love Cronenberg, but oof, Naked Lunch. The movies that Cronenberg did that aren't overtly body horror are the ones that actually disturb me more. It's the ones that bother me the most. Like that, Dead Ringers, like those movies are not really graphic, but they bother me. They really upset me a lot. Those are the types of movies that I don't ever want to watch again. I've watched them one time and I'm like, I'm done. Don't need to watch those movies ever again. I am upset by it. It made me feel uncomfortable. Thoroughly uncomfortable, those movies. I don't know. I love RoboCop. I'm trying to think of other things I haven't touched on. I think I've touched on all my bullet points, Andrew. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you wanted to talk about?
So I think there's two other things we need to touch on briefly.
Okay.
Thing number one, help me out here. Did Officer Lewis know Murphy for more than like an afternoon? Because she seems really attached to him after going through this thing over the course of the day. You know, whatever. Movies do shortcuts. I just wasn't sure if there was some kind of passage of time that I hadn't quite picked up on my first viewing.
I don't think so. I think it's largely, I think she feels responsible for his death. I think she,
it's a traumatic experience.
I think that largely is the reason why she cares after the fact, is like she feels responsible. Like she felt like she let him down because he called for her help and the crook got one over on her.
The second point that I think we need to hit is how this is another brick in the wall to bring us full circle as to why Robbie liked Westworld. there's a lot of the same stuff, not just robots coming to life and having feelings, but also that sort of, you know, corrupt corporate executive type being a major player and having that shadowy conspiracy part being part of the whole deal as well. Like, I think there's some substantial shared DNA that helps account for me why at least season one was catnip for Robbie.
I have a type. movies about search, self-actualization, searching for the ideals of self, and if they also involve grand conspiracies and mysteries about corporations, even the all the better. And robots.
Social give me critiques.
Give me robots. All that. Yeah, give me all that. If you've got a big I think I've said that openly. Like, yeah, I don't care. I'll just feed it to me. Just give me all you got. I'll keep eating. I don't care. Give me more. Buffet.
1987, also the year that we got Data from Star Trek The Next Generation.
I love Data. Data's great.
Same theme, same ideas. I mean, not obviously in the exact same way, but same robots asserting their identity and humanity.
Yeah, and many of these actors appeared in Star Trek.
This is true.
Many over the years.
Kerwin Smith, president of the Federation even. Or president of, yeah, president of the Federation, not president of Star Trek.
Space president.
Space president. Outer space president. That's what I want to be when I grow up.
Effectively, that's what he is. But, I mean, he's, isn't he like one of the corrupt, terrible, like, isn't there's like the joke that once you become admiral or above, you suddenly become a terrible monster.
No, I think he's implied to be pretty decent, I remember correctly.
All right. I don't remember.
He's being taken advantage of, I want to say. It's been a while.
Yeah. I decided to take a break on my Star Trek and just watch X-Files instead, so.
They save him from an assassin. That's their big triumphant moment. So presumably if he was truly bad, he would have gotten killed whether through the actions of Captain Kirk or through some other, you know, very convenient karma that takes him out of the way. I think he's supposed to be a good guy.
Okay.
Which he is assuredly not in RoboCop.
Well, this was where he started playing a bunch of bad guys until he became a dad in that 70s show.
And not for nothing, he is the antagonist in the Zeta Project, where he is chasing another robot. So he's got a type too.
And Peter Weller in Screamers is also, in that case, he is trying to hunt and avoid androids and AI versus becoming one himself.
Playing against type.
Screamers is a good movie. Underrated. Mid-90s kind of schlocky action movie, sci-fi action. It's actually pretty good. I don't know. RoboCop's great. I love
RoboCop
it.
RoboCop is great. Two thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
Well, assuming it's got my thumb and your thumb.
Okay, so I got it.
That's two.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give it my own two thumbs, so I would give it three thumbs up, frankly. Because I got two thumbs, Andrew.
You can only contribute one thumb. By definition, that is the most thumb anyone can give.
Okay. Now we got our Futurama references in here, too. It's important.
No, that's Simpsons.
Is that Simpsons?
Yeah, that's the hypnotist for the baseball team.
Oh, right. Did they not make that same joke in Futurama at some point?
I don't remember it, but you could be right. They could be, Matt Groening and company could be repeating themselves.
I've just been watching season 15 of The Simpsons, so I don't remember anything good anymore. All the good years are gone. Those are erased, unfortunately.
Does RoboCop ever cameo on The Simpsons? I feel like there's at least some reference to him, but I can't dredge it up at the moment.
What is this? Okay. Oh, here we go. Yeah, there's lots of references to RoboCop in The Simpsons.
Well, that's reassuring.
There's multiple, like I'm looking at the wiki and there's in Last Tap Bands of Springfield, there is a show called The Cyber Organizer, which looks exactly like RoboCop. Multiple Treehouse of Horror segments where there's RoboCop. There's Ionoid Gruntbot. Ralph is the robot that they use is called the Ralph O'Cop, which is just a picture of Ralph on a robot. And he fights.
So good fond memories of that episode for you.
Yeah. They fight Ed 209 in that, basically. So, there's lots of Simpsons references. Not RoboCop references in The Simpsons. I mean, I'm glad that you can find an 80s movie that you actually like, Andrew.
They do exist. The batting average is not high, but they do exist. And when I like them, I tend to really like them.
You just gotta like some more dirty and ugly stuff. That's the answer.
See, that's the thing. I feel like the 70s are like if you like dirty and ugly things. The 80s are if you want bright and cartoony things.
The Terminator is not bright or cartoony.
It's cartoony. It may not be bright. It may be too dark to see what's happening sometimes, but I don't know if I would.
I would not call the Terminator. I don't know what Terminator you watch. Were you Terminator 2 is cartoony? Absolutely, 100% with you. Terminator 1 is not cartoony. Like, it's all about a terrorless machine that will just go after you until you die. There's no, I don't know. That's a grim movie to me. There's no happiness there. There's no, like, cheesy. There's no, like, the one-liners are all incidental. They're all, like, I'll be back. You know, that's not, they didn't intend that to be a catchphrase. That was intended to be chilling.
Well, maybe we will do Terminator for our next 1980s action appointment. And you can hear me rail against James Cameron and his creative bankruptcy.
Oh, James Cameron. He contributed to Predator too. He contributed to the design of the alien in Predator, so that maybe
he is a great technologist and he is a great designer, and I wish him all the luck in the world in that. He is just a terrible storyteller. He should be on the technological production side of movies. He just shouldn't try to tell stories.
But aren't you looking forward to Avatar 3?
Yeah, I'm in the alternate universe in which those movies are going to come out.
Oh, no, they're not going to?
I mean, wasn't Avatar 2 supposed to come out in, like, I don't know, what, 2012?
Oh, I have no
idea. I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, I tell you what, there's too much money for them not to try at some point, but I feel like they are going to slowly but surely peter out Fantastic Beasts style.
I don't want more Avatar movies to exist, but I think that they will eventually make more Avatar movies. It made over $1 billion, Andrew. They're going
to
make more.
Yeah, there's profit to be had.
There's like, oh yeah, people like looking at computer wallpapers, like they like flying toasters. That's what we're going to make more Avatar movies.
Woof.
I mean, that's what that movie is. It's a wallpaper. It's colorful, and there's a lot of things happening on the screen, and you're like, whoa, look at that. Like, look, there's a robot fighting an alien.
A robot that vaguely looks like Ed 209?
Not vaguely. Yeah, I mean, it's a mech. They all borrow from the same stuff. That's fine. RoboCop, we're going to stop talking about Avatar. RoboCop 97 is a is a great film. I'm thankful that you watched it and we talked about it, Andrew. What would you like to plug before we go?
I'm going to plug Robbie's new book, War on Halloween, which you may have already heard an ad for, but I got to be one of the first people to read it. It is very good. It is one of Robbie's best works, and you should go check it out. If you want to hear me talk about it and other things, you can find me on Twitter at the Andrew Blog or my website, theandrewblog.net.
That's very kind of you, Andrew. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and my website is robbiedorman.com. You'll find links there for my other podcasts and a link to purchase my horror novels, including my newest novel, War on Halloween. War on Halloween is a suspense horror story about a family fighting for Halloween in a town controlled by a sinister reverend with secret occult powers. You can read it for free on Kindle Unlimited. The show's website is serialfanatist.com, and if you like the show, please give it a good review on Apple Podcasts, whatever podcast service you use. Subscribe, tell your friends. All those things help out. The show helped me out. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.